And we started our organization here with just a single grade level, one school, and have slowly built that one school up into a four school network with a district office. And that's what United Schools Network is. And even in a place where we're sort of starved of resources, because of our focus on training and the development of our people, we've been able to be super successful.
Welcome to another episode of Learning Life. I'm your host, John Toda, and we're happy to have you back this week. My guest today is John Deuce, the Chief Learning Officer for United Schools Network, a charter management organization in Columbus, Ohio, and the Managing Director of the School Performance Institute, which is focused on identifying practices that will improve education in high-poverty districts, then share them with other schools. Before that, John was the school director for Columbus Collegiate Academy and head of school for two prep schools in Cleveland, Ohio. With over two decades of experience in several levels of education, and specifically in the charter school space, John has a wealth of knowledge to share on the state of education today and how we can innovate on it and level the playing field for all students going forward. So, John Deuce, welcome to Learning Life.
Yeah, thanks for having me, John.
So obviously you've been in this space for a very long time at all different levels, both like running the school at the charter school level and now what you're doing as the chief learning officer. How, going all the way back, which is about 20 years now, how did you get into the education space originally? Was that always your plan?
No, it was actually mostly by accident. I grew up in a small town in Ohio, went to Miami of Ohio, majored in psychology, had the intentions of going on and being a clinical psychologist. But my senior year, I did a project where I focused on some kids' experiences on psychostimulants like Ritalin. And that really piqued my interest in the education sector. So I decided to apply to a sort of an alternative teaching program called Teach for America. And I ended up becoming a fifth grade teacher in Atlanta Public Schools for the first 3 years of my career. And even after that, I had a great experience, but even after that, sort of considered some other avenues, considered school psychology, took the LSAT, considered law school. But every time I tried to sort of step out, something would pull me back into the sector. And clearly now, after two decades, I call myself a lifer in this space.
Yeah. Well, it's great to see too that like you follow that passion and it keeps bringing you back. Now, I know so much of your experience now is working in the charter school space, and specifically with the charter management organization like United Schools Network. Tell our listeners a little bit about, because you and I were talking earlier, and even I didn't have a very clear understanding of charter schools and where they fall in the whole landscape of education. So tell our listeners a little bit about charter schools from your perspective, and what makes them different than just any normal public school that we run into?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think, as a sector, there's sort of a lot of misconception about charters. And I also think the sector is now large enough that there's probably as much variation within the sector as there is, sort of within public education in general. And so there are charter schools of all different types across the country, but in Ohio, at least, all charters are public schools. By law, all charters in Ohio are also nonprofit organizations. And so there's no tuition for students. We get state and federal funding. We don't get local funding. And so there's some inequity there. But really, what we are in Ohio is an option in areas of the state where school districts have struggled for a long time. And so in Ohio, and this isn't true in all states, but in Ohio, charter schools, by and large, can only exist in places that where the schools have struggled. And so, in fact, is also where neighborhoods struggle. So most of the places where charters are located in Ohio are some of the most disadvantaged neighborhoods in the state.
Yeah, and now that is similar across all cities and states in the United States, right? That they're typically charter schools are employed in the areas where they don't have good public school systems and they're higher poverty areas. Is that always accurate?
Yeah, I'd say the only exception is there are some states where charters can exist statewide. And there's places like Colorado where charters exist in pretty affluent areas. And then the other exception is there are charters that serve a specific student population, such as students with autism. And in those cases, then they're not always located in disadvantaged neighborhoods. But by and large, the vast majority of charter schools are serving a population of students that is majority economic disadvantaged.
Got it. And it does kind of raise the stakes considerably for the work that you do, because you know it's of such greater need than just any public school obviously in a more affluent neighborhood where they have a lot more opportunity. Is this kind of why the School Performance Institute got created, and that's why you're looking at creating improvement in that area? Is that kind of the genesis of that?
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, what we've found, all the schools that I've worked in, both traditional public and then the public charters that I've worked for, have all been sort of high poverty schools. And what we see there, not surprisingly, is that, you know, the students that are in those schools come to school with additional challenges. And, you know, in the charter sector, because of lower funding levels and a number of other things, at least in Ohio, you also see more inexperienced teachers in those schools, especially during their startup phase. And so at this point, I've been a part of seven nonprofit startups. Five of those have been schools, and the vast majority start with teachers that are sort of on the lower experience level, because that's sort of who's looking for jobs at startups, generally speaking. And so we had to be very deliberate about onboarding and training folks. One, because the kids that we're serving need great teachers. And two, you know, many of the folks that we're sort of onboarding are coming to us with like less experience. I think the other side is, you know, it's really hard to, even when you're good for a little while, it's really hard to maintain that. And so we had to have this mindset of continuous improvement to make sure that, you know, our results stayed where we wanted them to stay.
So, yeah, it kind of seems counterintuitive, right, that the areas that need the education the most are not getting the most skilled teachers, right, that like they're not getting what they need. And I think one of these initiatives then is to continually improve the teachers and their skill set and just the curriculum overall for the students, right, because you're not starting with the best, the top line teachers, probably because of cost reasons, right?
Yeah, and I would say the teachers themselves generally lack experience, but the potential is definitely there, and so we have to find a way to get that potential up to speed as quickly as possible, because that's what our students need and deserve. And I think sort of, you know, the idea for SPI sort of tracks against my experience in the education sector. So, you know, I started in Atlanta, and what I saw there were sort of islands of really great teaching, but sort of a lack of a cohesive school-wide plan. And then I took my first job in a charter school in Denver. It was a startup charter school there. And one of the first things that the head of school there, Chris Gibbons, did was send me to Boston to see a couple outstanding charter schools in action. It really sort of changed my perception of what was possible when you have a group of adults that are all on the same page and aligned to a mission. And then sort of I took those experiences back to Columbus, and we started our organization here with just a single grade level, one school, and have slowly built that one school up into a four school network with a district office. And that's what United Schools Network is. And even in a place where we're sort of starved of resources, because of our focus on training and the development of our people, we've been able to be super successful.
No, I think it's really interesting. And so I guess you're getting teachers in the charter school system that have less experience, but there's probably a lot of positives to that as well, because they could still be just as talented as the most experienced teacher. They just haven't gotten their shot yet. They're coming like almost like a blank slate into your system. So you could have a I would imagine their passion level is really high. They're very motivated. They're, you know, very little experience, but because they're new to it, they've got that excitement level that's great to work with. And then is this where you kind of layer in improvement science and say, okay, we're going to take someone who's got all the characters we want in a great teacher, but just hasn't had the opportunity to earn the experience yet. And if we can put this system in place, we'll improve them on the job because you don't have that luxury of training them and skilling them up before they're on the job. Is that kind of the idea?
Yeah, I think, you know, with the new teachers, we're really focused on those, more of those sort of improvement essentials. And so what we find is, not exclusively, but a lot of teachers coming out of traditional education preparation programs almost have to be retrained. For whatever reason, sometimes things like the science of reading and cognitive science or how people learn, sort of they are not correctly taught. We found in a lot of ed schools, some schools they are, some schools they're not. So a lot of our summer training is actually focused on how does someone learn to read from a cognitive science standpoint and make sure all of our folks are trained in a way that's aligned to what the science says works best for kids.
Yeah, so I think it's fascinating too, because you do have that added benefit of not having to retrain people or train them into a different way. And that's something, you know, a lot of our listeners are corporate educators. And so they're listening to this and thinking about, you know, what can I take from this episode back to, you know, our life in, you know, in the corporate world. And I think it's one of those similarities is that you get a lot of people in these learning and development roles in corporate America that haven't had any experience previously. They might have been good in a role, and so they just, you know, gave them a promotion into, you know, heading up the training in that area, but they never had any of those skill sets or anything. You know, I love what you talk about with improvement science and these improvement essentials. What are some of the things that anyone, regardless of what level of education they're at or the nature of education, could implement to improve the skill sets of their trainers or their educators in those improvement essential areas?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's three things that come to mind. One was, it was right there for me to sort of understand, but I didn't understand it until a few years ago. And I really started studying improvement science. And, you know, one thing that I think would apply regardless of the sector, and that is that professional development and organizational improvement are two very different things. So professional development is, you know, typically targeted at improving the skills of an individual practitioner, right? So if I am a hospital and I want a surgeon to, you know, improve a certain technique, then professional development makes a lot of sense on that particular surgical technique. If I'm thinking about improving my organization and improving problems that are facing my organization, I need to take a very different sort of path to improvement that focuses at the organizational level and not at the individual level. And so that was a real eye-opener when that sort of dawned on me that those are two very different things. I think a second thing that comes to mind is whenever we're trying to improve a problem in any organization, I think we are too quick to jump to solutions. I think that whenever I start an improvement project with a school, one of the first things I do is put up on a slide an Einstein quote that says, if I had only 1 hour to save the world, I'd spend 55 minutes defining the problem and only 5 minutes finding the solution. And similarly, John Dewey said, a problem well put is half solved. I think that we as organizational leaders, whether we're in the business sector and we're feeling sort of the pressure of shareholders, or we're in the public education sector and we feel pressure to improve test scores, because of that urgency, because of that pressure, I think leaders, organizational leaders, are often pushed to say what our solutions are too fast. And it's before we fully understand a problem. And when that happens, then typically the solutions are mismatched to the root cause of the problem in the first place. And when we don't understand the deep structure of the problems we're trying to improve, basically what we do is we go fast and big, we learn slow, we burn the goodwill of the people on the front lines. The thing we're trying to improve doesn't improve over time. We abandon that solution, even if there was a sort of a kernel of wisdom in that solution. And then we go on to the next thing. And we do that over and over and over again. And I think sort of slowing down the speed up, we call it sort of learning fast to implement well, is one of my main jobs, actually, when I start working with a school district, is to get that superintendent or that principal to slow down and understand the underlying problem. And then third thing we talk about, it's actually one of our core values, is think small, start small. And, you know, I got a lot of pushback. Well, what about think big, but start small? And I see so much that sort of think big, start big, that I thought something that was sort of directly counter to that was really important to hold on to. And so to me, think small, start small is this idea that innovation usually flows from like small ideas, small tests that slowly sort of grow through iterations, but only after you understand the context that that problem is sitting in. And so I think those three things, the sort of professional development and organizational improvement, are two different things. This idea of deeply understanding a problem before moving on to solutions, even to a point of uncomfortableness, and then sort of thinking small, starting small, and iterating on solutions, even if you're starting with a single student or a single classroom before, you know, you decide to grow a change idea to like a whole school or a whole district. I think those are three sort of lessons that I sort of repeat over and over again in both my internal and external work.
Yeah, I love those. And I think there's so much truth in that, regardless of the nature of your education, whether it's at the corporate level with workers in the workplace, or with students at any different level. So yeah, I think that's awesome. Great three tips there. So now I have a question for you. One of the things that we run up against in the corporate world all the time is the way that the workforce is changing so much going forward. And if you look 5 years in the future, the skill sets that are going to be needed in the workforce, we don't even know what they are now with automation and everything, that a lot of roles are being replaced by machines. And there's these skill sets and a lot of soft skills that need to be developed in individuals in our workforce now that are new and different from what we might have trained them on before. How are you seeing that at this level with, you know, even dealing with students in K through 12 and getting them prepared for this new future of workforce, and how the whole nature of work will change, and the requirement of really having a greater dependency on soft skills? Is that impacting you in the way you're designing curricula at your level and in education overall now?
How to answer that from an education standpoint is that I think content matters to a great degree. And so when I'm looking at a world, you know, I have three kids of my own that are elementary age, and when I think about what do they need to be successful in the future, I actually don't think it's that different than the past. What separates an expert like a professor in a certain area from a novice learner? It's content. And it's not only the amount of content they know in their subject area, but because of the time they spend with that content, it's actually organized in a different way in their brain. And so I think content expertise, be it in the sciences or math or in the liberal arts, is incredibly important. And I get the sort of push for different types of skills like critical thinking or collaboration. But you know, what we always say when we're training new teachers and thinking about a novice learner is that you can't critically think about nothing, right? You have to have lots of content knowledge in long-term memory in order to critically think about it. And so when we're talking about novice learners, and I consider just about all K-12 kids novice learners, there's really a lot of content that they need to learn at this age to make sure that they can do the things that I think people are talking about when they say like 21st century skills. But I think if a kid comes out of K-12 and can read and write and do math at a high level and has content knowledge, I think they're well on their way to being set up for success in sort of the changing economic system that we're experiencing.
And I think your point's right on, is that, you know, they still need that baseline of content. And I had an interview with someone that I thought was really interesting. He said, you know, we don't really add collaboration, critical thinking, creativity to our curriculum in any way. It's just the way that we might structure our teaching. We might be more collaborative in the classroom than we were in the past. And that's going to teach them to work more in a team-oriented situation and things like that. He said, but, you know, we're not necessarily changing our content in any way, because like you said, the content's still the same. You still need to learn that. It may be in the process of learning that you start to pick up more of these social skills or these soft skills that you know you're going to need in the long term. And so now technology is always a big point for me, because I look at the way that learning is done today and how much of it is done with computers and different types of technology to assist the learner. How much in the charter school world, how much technology do you have at your disposal? Is it the same as we would expect in every public school or less? And how much is that changing and evolving the way that you're teaching kids today?
You know, in terms of access to technology, I think we're pretty similar to traditional public schools. And I think that access can vary a lot between different types of districts and different types of schools. But we're generally one-to-one with Chromebooks in all of our schools. And so we do think it's important that students have access to technology as a tool. I would say it's not, especially in the earlier grades, it's not a huge emphasis. I think I go back to what I just talked about, this idea of knowledge mattering and content mattering. I think kids being able to write and read and analyze text and those types of things are really important. I think you can do that with or without technology. I do think the ability to sort of analyze data in different ways is significantly being impacted by how we're thinking about and using technology, and especially, you know, how we're grabbing technology. Lots of school systems have lots of disparate platforms that all this different data is sitting in. And I think we're thinking a lot about how do we grab that data from different platforms and put it into a place that's usable for our staff, which that can then in turn benefit our students. And right now we're spending a tremendous amount of time putting that data together. And so we're trying to figure out ways to streamline that so that we can spend more time acting on the data to benefit our students.
Yeah, and I guess from that perspective, you'd probably say that the technology's more leveraged at the teacher level so that they can be more effective. They can spend more time personalizing the curriculum for each individual student and spending more time with them on a one-on-one basis, and having the management technology management tools, as opposed to trying to get the kids to do so much more in, you know, using computers in the classroom and all of that.
Yeah, I think it's a little of both. I mean, we obviously recognize that kids have to have certain technological skills to be competitive. I think, you know, we're a little bit unique because our four schools, we have two elementary and two middle, so we're only K-8. And so my answer may be a little bit different if we had a high school in our network, you know, as those kids start to think about college and career preparation. But the K-8 level, I think, you know, there's certain skills that we want our kids to have. All of our state tests, for example, are now online. So there's certain skills that you have to be able to take those tests. I would just say that we recognize that it's a tool and it's not the answer. I think the answer is how the adults organize and align in service of the kids more than what the technology does. The technology is certainly a useful tool for both students and adults.
Right. And I guess it goes back to your comment earlier, too, is that the content is what's really important. And if the technology aids in delivering that content more efficiently or cost effectively, great. But you're not deploying technology just for the sake of having computers in the classroom.
Yeah, and I think I take sort of a hard stance on this because I hear things that make me cringe, like, well, you don't have to teach kids all these facts because they can look it up on Google. And that just makes me cringe because, well, you don't know how to sort of interpret that information if you don't have a lot of content knowledge at your disposal to sort of help you wade through what is reliable and what's not, what's valid and what's not, and what's meant to be, you know, misleading or, you know, propaganda. It's very difficult to evaluate those online resources if you don't have a significant grounding in whatever content you're looking at.
Yeah, and that's a point for me too. I've got three kids in elementary school now as well. And I look at them and I do think they've got so much more data at their fingertips. My oldest just got his first phone. And so it's like, he's like, any question you ask him, he immediately goes right to his phone. And I'm like, it's cool. It's actually super cool that you know to do that. But at the same time, it's almost like it's made it too easy in some ways. And so I'm like, so for you as an educator by trade and a parent, where do you draw the line with your own kids on that? Do you put limits on the screen time? Do you want them to go and find things the old fashioned way versus using technology? What are some of the things you're doing there?
Well, I mean, honestly, you know, I don't have a lot of hard and fast rules. I mean, we have the kids share an iPad. So I guess it's helpful that there's three of them. There's only one iPad. So there's some division of time there. I think to me, you know, a well-rounded kid is a kid that has access to technology. I think reading traditional books is super important. So we put an emphasis on, you know, doing that for a certain amount of time every night. And I think kids just getting outside and running and playing is super important. And so what we try to do is really just balance between those three things. Like I said, I don't have hard and fast rules, but I think, you know, if they can be outside, they should be outside. And then second is if they're inside, then a book, reading a traditional book is a great way to spend time. And then, you know, there's some time for screen time to watch whatever they watch, YouTube videos or those types of things. So I think it really a balance. But my emphasis, you know, would be on the physical activity and the reading of the books if I was prioritizing.
Yeah, I think that's great. And so on that, my final thing I want to ask you is just looking at the future of education, and particularly like in your case, you're dealing with K-8. But you know, a lot of people would say probably some of the most critical years for a student to form the basis of learning and their love of learning. So where do you see kind of when you look forward 3 years from now, 5 years from now, where do you see it going? Do you see it changing or and obviously you're really focused on improvement science. How do you see it improving and maybe being different or better in the future for kids?
Yeah, I think in terms of our focus, you know, one of the things that we're super focused on is a project we call Eighth Grade On Track. And one of the things we know from the research is that this transition from eighth grade to ninth grade is the most tenuous in a kid's academic career. So to the point where the researchers call it the make or break year. So you can fall so far off track as you go from eighth to ninth grade that you never basically get back on track. And we're trying to figure out ways to throw support at that critical juncture in a kid's academic career. So we only have elementary and middle schools, and we're really focused on how we get our eighth graders on track for high school readiness. But then we also have a program where we follow those kids into high school and college and try to sort of support them at that critical juncture. And I think we have a long way to go to have everything in place that we need to do that support. But I think there's this misnomer where kids, you know, get off track and it's because of socioeconomic status or, you know, things like that. But really it's just that they just need a little extra support at a critical juncture in their life. And then they stay on track. And so in terms of a specific project, that's something we're really focused on. And I think it sort of flows out of this idea of we have access to this data. It used to be that folks like the Gates Foundation were sort of funding these top-down reform initiatives, but they've recognized that now we have this data, and how do we use that data focused on local improvement efforts that really take the context of a city or even a neighborhood into account to support the kids in that neighborhood or city to make the transitions during those critical junctures, like eighth grade and ninth grade, or as they transition to college and career. So we're really thinking about how can we apply that improvement science methodology to those critical junctures to support kids and keep them sort of, we sort of think of it as a leaky pipeline. A few kids leak out in eighth grade and then a little bit more in ninth and then in 10th, and then as they transition to college, how do we keep more kids on that path to having options down the line?
Yeah, I think that's great. And obviously so important, particularly because, and I think as you're noting, going from eighth grade to ninth grade, getting into high school for the first time, obviously the education aspect gets more challenging. The stakes are a little bit higher, but you're also dealing with more the social elements coming in, like now trying to fit in with the crowd, and they're at that age that they're hitting. You could see where their studies could take a backseat if they're left to fall off that track.
Yeah, that's right. And we're really thinking about things like nudge theory and how do we just give them nudges at critical points to sort of nudge them back in the right direction when they're making the decision between should I study or should I, you know, go out with my friends, you know, those types of things. How can we support them as they make those decisions, especially in early high school?
Yeah, I think that's awesome. And obviously so important developing the future of our workforce and our society. So, John, thank you so much. I mean, everything that you shared, a ton of great best practices that anyone at any level of education or training could use in their day-to-day life, and just sharing your experience. So thank you for being here.
Yeah, I really appreciate the opportunity, and thanks for the invite, John.
And for all of our listeners, if they want to find out more about you, I know you put some great articles out on LinkedIn and everything. Is LinkedIn the best way to kind of follow what you're up to in the school system there?
Yeah, I think LinkedIn is a good spot. We also, on our website, which is schoolperformanceinstitute.org, we have a Learning to Improve tab where we post all of our articles there as well.
Oh, that's awesome. So we'll put both your LinkedIn profile link in the show notes, as well as it's schoolperformanceinstitute.org.
Yep, that's right.
Yep. And we'll include that in the show notes as well. So if any of you listeners are interested in learning more about what John is up to and what the School Performance Institute can share, definitely check it out. And again, thank you, John, for being here. And to all of our listeners, thank you for being here every week. As you know, we have a new episode coming out each week. So wherever you're listening, make sure you subscribe and leave us comments. We'd love to hear from you. And until next week, happy learning. Our show is made possible by our sponsor, KnowledgeLink, the online training platform that improves the skill sets of your employees and helps to make a company's people their most valuable asset. Check KnowledgeLink out on a free trial today at getknowledgelink.com.